Yeah, again, we just mentioned different thoughts from the Maharal and bringing in other Mepharshim as well. I want to continue about...
Do we have the text?
Not at this point. Okay. Yeah, but I want to share with you a thought that the Maharal talks about on these Parshiyos of Yetzias Mitzrayim. You know, there's a Gemara that says the following. Gemara Nedarim says, why was there a Golos Mitzrayim? What sin was there in the Jewish people or the Avos that necessitated there to be a Golos in Mitzrayim? Hashem told Avram that you'll be enslaved for 400 years. Although they were only there for 210 years, but the Gezeirah was for 400 years. So the Gemara identifies three Averos on the part of Avram Avinu that precipitated this decree. One was that when God promised him Eretz Yisrael, Avraham said, "Bama eida ki arshena." What proof do I have? How do I know that my children will inherit the land? That was said to be, according to one opinion in Chazal, a lack of emuna. It's a lack of emuna, and this lack of faith in the divine promise caused the punishment of Yetzias Mitzrayim. Of course, it's very, very difficult, because if you look in that very parsha, it says, "V'hamin b'Hashem," he believed in Hashem, "V'yachshevel lo tzedak," and God considered it a merit. It's very difficult to say that parsha is a lack of emuna in asking for ma'eda. And if you look at Rashi does not interpret it as a lack of emuna. Rather, Avram is asking, "B'ezo zechus," what merit, what mitzvah can my children do that they will be able to hold on to Eretz Yisrael? So he's not questioning God's promise. He's asking God for information as to what is the zechus. But be it as it may, there's no question, although it's difficult in terms of the psukim, Chazal do have at least one opinion that identifies Bama Eida as a lack of emuna in God. That's one interpretation, or to some degree, a lack of emuna. Now, minuscule, as it were, but for Avraham Avinu, this was enough for there to be a taina, a tevia, as it were. The second interpretation that Gemara gives is a very interesting one. That is, when Abraham went to save Lot, when Lot was captured by the four big kings that were fighting against the smaller kings, so Lot was captured. So the pasuk says, in Lech Lecha, Vayarek es chanichav, he mobilized his trainees, Yelidei Beso, those that were born in his home. Simple meaning is Avram had a lot of slaves, and he mobilized his slaves to be an army to capture Lot. Chazal say that these chanichav is a lashon of chinuch. These were his talmidim who were learning Torah, although we're not sure again what Torah there was before Matan Torah, but there was Torah. And he was punished because he took people away from their learning in order to fight a military battle. Now this obviously... It took only one day, but even one day. All right, so the question is, yeah, I mean, obviously the question is, well, did Tuach Nefesh Lot have to be saved? But the issue is, he could have gotten other people. He didn't have to be Mavato people from Torah. Now, that Gemara obviously has extreme relevance for the issue of drafting yeshiva students and everything else. And, you know, that's a big question.
Another question was,
from the Well, it doesn't say that there was some sin in saving Lot. After all, Hashem saved Lot. Hashem wanted Lot to be saved from Sodom. But this is called Asa Angaria, the Talmidei Chachamim. He used Talmidei Chachamim for a rescue mission. Of course, keep in mind, this was a private rescue mission. I mean, it was an individual, as it were. Of course, you know, the issue of draft firmness for B'nai Torah is a very, very difficult issue. Ben-Gurion agreed in 1948 before the State of Israel even existed, that students who were studying full-time in yeshiva should be exempt from military service, which, by the way, is the same law in the United States. It's not the unique Israeli thing. But, of course, Ben-Gurion believed... You know, how many yeshiva students were studying in those days? Yeah, you know, 200. And then Gurion believed that Torah life was going to be on the decline anyway. Therefore, he figured this would be an extinct thing. It's like a dinosaur that'll just be out of the way, not realizing, of course, that you now have so many people learning, and now there are all sorts of questions. And as you know, even politically now, there are people who are Haredim in the Haredi camp who are suggesting some type of military service in all religious units and the like, similar a little bit to the Hester, although Hester is a different model, because Hester there is a complete integration of the religious with the non-religious, the Haredim one separate, but this is an issue. But be as it may, Chazal do clearly identify that there's a certain primacy in Limud HaTorah, in which you don't take them away unless you have to fight in a military effort. Well, here's the thing. You know, people like to quote. You know, there are two types of wars, just to be sure everyone is familiar with the term. Milchemes Mitzvah is a war that there's a mitzvah and an obligation to fight. And the Rambam says there are three types of wars that are Milchemes Mitzvah. There is the war to conquer the land of Israel. There is the war to eradicate Amalek. And then there's the war to defend the Jewish people who are under attack anywhere. And all of those are Milchemes Mitzvah. Now, if you remember, in Parshas Shoftim, the Torah says certain people are exempt from going to war. It mentions a person who built a house and did not yet live in it, a person who planted a vineyard and did not yet enjoy the fruit, a person who betrothed a woman and had not been consummated. In those days, there was actually a year between the erusin, the kedushin, and the marriage. So the Gemara said, and then there's a fourth exemption, very interesting exemption, Yorei v'rachaleva, people who are scared get to go home. Now there's a machlokas in the Gemara. Well, it's a machlokas in the Gemara. One opinion says, scared means a person is scared because of their sins, because of their aveiros. Of course, that's a little strange, because that would suggest that the only people who would stay in war are the greatest tzaddikim who would stay in war. And the greatest tzaddikim were probably more afraid of their aveiros. The other opinion is a person that is very frightened. There was an unusual military exemption for extremely frightened people. And the Gemara says, because it was recognized that that could have a tremendously devastating impact on combat morale. It's hard to know exactly. How do you measure? I mean, everyone is frightened, but kind of a fright that is contagious. Mm-hmm. Now, the Gemara then says that these exemptions only apply to what is called milchemes rishus, optional wars. What is an optional war? Well, we can't do that today, but an optional war was a war of aggressive expansionism. Aye, that doesn't sound like a Jewish thing. Well, it could only be authorized by the Urim Bitumim, that prophetic inspiration, meaning God, for whatever reason, said to do it. Meaning today, since we don't have Urim Bitumim, we do not recognize any legitimacy in an aggressive war, unless it's a preemptive war to prevent attack. But Milchemes Mitzvah, to conquer Eretz Yisrael, to destroy Amalek, to defend Jews if they're under attack, and even a preemptive strike, it says there is no such thing as an exemption. It says, Afilu chasan mechedro, the bridegroom in the yichud room, you go to the chasna, you pull out the chasan from the yichud room and say, go fight. And it even says, kala mechupasa, the kala is dragged, which raises the other issue. Does this suggest in the Milchemes Mitzvah that women should fight? Right? That's another issue besides the... Now here's the thing. What is the status of the wars that the Jews in the state of Israel fight today? Are they classified as Milchemes Mitzvah, or are they classified as Milchemes Rishus? Most would say that certainly if Israel is under attack, as it was in 48 and in 56 and in 67 and in 73, that would certainly qualify as a Milchemes Mitzvah, because that is to defend Jews who are being attacked. Today, of course, you have the internal wars, which are really, even if they're international law, they're not called war, but they are essentially internal wars, intifadas, whatever it is, and that would be Milchemes Mitzvah. There is a bit of a question in halacha when the Israeli army goes into another country, like Lebanon, to erase targets. Is that called Milchemes Mitzvah or not? Because technically speaking, it's not defensive, but it is for the purpose of preventing attack. Yeah, part of it. No, that might be an issue. Yeah, that might be an issue too, how far the boundaries of Eretz Israel go. Now, here's the question. If we assume that the wars that Israel generally fights qualify as Milchemes Mitzvah, which makes sense for two reasons, actually. One is it's to conquer and retain Eretz Yisrael, and the other is it's to defend Jewish lives from being killed. There are two different reasons why it's Melchemes Nesach. That would indicate there are no exemptions. Meaning, but the question becomes the following. The exemptions of the Torah don't apply, meaning the guy with the vineyard, the guy with the house, the guy who just got married, got to go. The question still becomes, is there an exemption for Limud HaTorah? Meaning, the Gemara does not say there are no exemptions at all. The Gemara says the exemptions in the Chumash don't apply, but there might be still an exemption of Talmud Torah. Now, here, there is a quotation from the Rambam at the end of the laws of Shemitah and Yovel, which is very, very interesting. And there's almost no source for this. Normally, everything the Rambam says, you can trace very directly to the Gemara. But occasionally, the Rambam says something for which we don't have a clear source. And the Rambam discusses the role of Shevet Levi, the tribe of Levi. And the tribe of Levi, the Rambam says, did not own lands, was not supposed to engage in business. The tribe of Levi was supposed to be the teachers and the scholars of Klal Yisrael. And the Rambam says, and therefore, Shevet Levi was exempt from going l'milchama. And the Rambam says, lo l'milchames rishus, v'lo l'milchames mitzvah. That Shevet Levi was exempt not only from the Milchemes Rishus, the optional war, but the Rambam says Shevet Levi was exempt even from Milchemes Mitzvah. Now, it's not clear what the source of the Rambam is for that. Some quote different Midrashim. But according to that, philosophically, that would be the idea that even when there's Milchemes Mitzvah, there needs to be a segment of the population that is involved in. Now, how much that should be, you know, that's always going to be a question. But nevertheless, there is a marker for that exemption, even by a Milchemes Mitzvah. But nevertheless, the classical attitude has been reflected, if you remember, by the 2.5 tribes. They wanted to settle in the east bank of the Yarden. So Moshe's response to them was a bit derisive. Moshe said, Achechem Yotzim L'Milchama. Your brothers are going out and risking their lives. Vatem Yoshvim Po, and you want to be here. So where things get very destructive is when people, let's say, who are learning Torah are disparaging towards people who are risking their lives. Meaning to say, if one is exempt because their contribution of studying Torah is very, very significant, by all means, they still have to relate to the people who are physically putting their lives in danger with a tremendous amount of respect. It can't be, you know, who needs you? So, but that's the issue, basically. And then the Shaila is, well, is Hester a good accommodation of that, where you learn and you fight, and do you do both, or should there be a whole exemption? Should some people be in one category, some people be in another category? By the way, Hester itself is not a single system. People have this confusion about the Hester arrangement, where they think, you know, the standard Hester is a five-year commitment, which you have 18 months or a little longer in the army. That's the standard Hester. But there are many, many different variations. There are people who go to Merkaz Harav, which, you know, was the first Hester yeshiva, and, you know, they learn 10 years with, you know, 3 months military. I mean, there are different arrangements. It's a very, very flexible. It's not a single type of thing, and different ways are worked out, you know. But at least from the perspective of secular Israelis, they often like to say, maybe it's not true, maybe it is true, but they often like to say that the single issue that they feel creates the greatest animosity between religious and secular is the fact that so many large segments of Haredim do not serve in the army. They like to say that is why, if only they would participate. One can debate whether that's a true statement or not, but certainly it is a source of a lot of tension and a lot of Agmas Nefesh. On the other hand, halakhically, there may be a basis for it based on the Rambam's ruling about Shevet Levi. And the Medrash Gemara that I quoted, that Avraham Avinu acted improperly in drafting Talmidei Chachamim to save Lot. Although, once again, maybe you can't compare saving Lot to Eretz Yisrael and everything else. And philosophically, of course, the argument is, which a Jew has to believe in, that Limud HaTorah does contribute very, very greatly. It's not like you're not doing anything for the national defense. Rather, Torah is something that creates Hashem's protection. The Gemara even says an interesting thing, that when they used to impose taxes for the upkeep of cities, for defenses of cities, so the Gemara mentions, Talmidei Chachamim were exempt from paying taxes for the upkeep of cities, because the Chachamim themselves brought protection to the cities by their learning, and therefore they already provided protection. Now, the Rama already writes in the 1500s, the Rama writes, that Bizman Hazeh, the tax exemption does not apply to a Talmud Chacham, so the IRS is not going to accept anyone's argument, and the reason is because the Rama writes, today we do not have anyone that qualifies the Talmud Chacham, so the standard must have been a very, very different standard. But there was such a concept that a Talmud Chacham did not have to pay taxes for the protection of the city, because he was already contributing to the protection of the city. Now, he would have to pay taxes for things like water, in other words, things like that, but he wouldn't have to pay taxes for police or protection, because he is bringing a certain measure of protection. All right, so that's the second Avera. So the first Avera was Bama Eda. How do I know that God will give me the land? Because I'll identify as that as a lack of emuna. The second Avera was he used Talmidei Chachamim in a draft. And then the third Avera is very, very fascinating. And it's also connected to this war. If you remember, after the war, and remember this was somewhat like World War II when the United States and our allies with Stalin. Remember, Saddam was on Abraham's side. Saddam was one of the five smaller kings. And Abraham saved Lot from the four Malachim. And then the Melech Saddam, who was Abraham's ally, okay, he was the ally then, went over to Abraham and said, Tainli HaNefesh, return to me all of my people that you liberated, who could have been Abraham's slaves or whatever, Baruchush Kachlach, and you can keep all the property. And if you remember, Abraham gave him back the Nefesh, but Abraham said, In michut biad Saruch now, I will not take a string or a shoelace from you, Shalot Tomar, that you shouldn't be able to say, Ani Hesharti es Abraham. Now, the Gemara says, Abraham not taking wealth from the king of Sodom was a very proper thing, because Abraham wanted his wealth to come from God. You'll ask Akasha, Abraham was perfectly willing to take wealth from Paro, right? When Paro sent away Sarah, it's a good Kasha. But apparently Abraham felt that since God had told him he would become wealthy, so he had to become wealthy, he had to fulfill Hashem's promise. But once he is wealthy, he doesn't want to take wealth from another person. And in fact, the Gemara says, in the merit of Abraham saying, I will not take michut biad saruch now, chut is a string of fabric, so his children were given the mitzvah of talis, the mitzvah of tzitzis, and the saruch now, the shoe strap, which is leather, they were given the mitzvah of tefillin. So tzitzis and tefillin come in the merit of michut biad saruch now. So that was a good thing. But what was a bad thing? He shouldn't have given the nefesh, the people, back to the king of Sodom, because he could have kept them in his home, and he could have been machnis them, he could have brought them tachas kanfei hashchina. He could have made them religious, God-fearing people. And he declined the opportunity by giving them back. And because he did not take the opportunity to be machnes people, tachas kante ashchina, he put them back into a godless, corrupt environment. I was thinking of the Elian Gonzalez case. Who knows? You know, the concept of you have someone in a certain environment and you give them back because that's where they come from. And yet, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says you decline the opportunity. Of course, some have argued that Cuba is a more ethical environment than the United States. And if people are asking, well, you know, who says that? Maybe the morality there is better. Who knows? But there is a concept that you don't simply say, oh, send him back where he came from. Rather, Hashem says, if you have an opportunity to have somebody in an environment that's more conducive to holiness, one is obligated. So these are three different chatayim the Gemara in the Dorim identifies as reasons for the Golas Mitzrayim. One is Bama Eda, which I say is actually difficult from the psukim, because the psukim don't indicate a lack of emunah there. The second is asa angarya b'talmidei chachamim, he drafted that. And the third is shelo hichnis nefashos tachas kanfei hashchina, he declined the opportunity to bring these souls under the kanfei hashchina. This is a gemara in the Dorim. Yeah. Well, you see this. You see. Apparently, why is the Melech Saddam even arguing with them? These are, I mean, apparently this was the rule of war, meaning if you liberated people in war, you acquired them as slaves. I mean, that apparently was the international law there, because otherwise, why does the Melech Saddam say Tainli Hanefesh? Like, these are just his people. The answer is that they were, by virtue of the Minhagim at that time. These apparently were slaves, and they were slaves of Sodom, but they were captured by the four kings, and Abraham recaptured them. So they would actually become Abraham's slaves. But Abraham gave them back. He didn't want to take anything. And although Chazal consider it correct that he did not take the Rechush, but he should have kept the Avadim. Which, you know, you see, in other words, you see the tremendous responsibility that if one has the ability to influence someone, in a good way, one cannot decline that responsibility. Now, the emphasis is, the Maral writes, that these are not reasons for the Churban. Because, after all, it seems a little disproportionate that because of Avraham had this Saveira, there should be 210 years of Churban. The Maral says the Gemara means a different thing. The Gemara does not mean this is why the Jewish people were enslaved. But the Gemara means this is why Hashem told Avraham that there would be a slavery. Because you see, the general way Hashem relates with Abraham is not to give him the bad news. For example, Hashem promises Abraham, Biata tavo el avosecha b'shalom, you will go to your fathers, you will die with peace. Kikaver b'seva tova, you will be buried in a good old age. And Rashi says this was a promise to Abraham that none of his descendants will be Yotzei L'Karbus Ra. None of them will become Rishayim in Abraham's lifetime. Esav did not publicly become a Rasha till the day that his grandfather Abraham died. That's why Yaakov is cooking lentils. And that's why he died earlier, right? So he shouldn't see it. Even Yishmael, according to Chazal, did Shuvah before Abraham's death. In fact, Abraham, when he married Keturah after Sarah died, Chazal say Keturah is Hagar. He actually took Hagar back again. She's called Keturah because she also was a righteous woman, at least after Sarah died. Noyim Maaseha Kiktoris. Her deeds were as pleasant as incense, Keturah. So Avram, everything comes together. He has a son Yitzchak. Keturah comes back. Yishmael comes back. Esav does not become a Rasha till Avram dies. So the Gemara is asking, why does Hashem tell Abraham about the Golus Mitzrayim? And the answer is, these are the three Averos. In other words, the Maral is saying, these are not the three Averos that cause the Korban. These are the three Averos which caused Hashem to tell Abraham about the Golus Mitzrayim. That the real reason for Golus Mitzrayim are not these three reasons. But the real reason is, it was a necessary step in the perfection and the creation of Klal Yisrael to be able to become a nation and to be able to inherit the land of Israel. Why is that so? Again, the Torah itself uses the phrase Kor HaBarzel. Kor HaBarzel is an iron furnace. And the analogy is when you have metals that are extracted from the ground, the ore is often filled with dirt, stones, and rock and impurities. And it is the fire of the smelting furnace that purifies and burns away the impurities. So you have pure, pure ore, let it be gold or silver. And therefore Mitzrayim is described always as the Kor HaBarzel, the iron furnace that burns away the impurities of character. How is that so? How is it a Kor HaBarzel? So here, again, I mentioned this before, you know, it's interesting that When we structure our Haggadah and we talk about Yetzias Mitzrayim, so the Gemara mentions that the Haggadah must begin with Gnus. It must begin with bad stuff. and culminate in good stuff. Meaning you cannot just talk about redemption. You must talk about the degradation. And this means two levels, both the slavery and the fact that we were idolaters in Terach's time. We combine all of that. Now, what is the idea of beginning with the Gnus and culminating in the redemption? Why can't I just talk about redemption? Why do I have to, as part of the mitzvah, remember the bad part? So there are two ways of understanding this. One way of understanding it is very simple. It is human nature that one appreciates goodness only when you contemplate its opposites. You appreciate health primarily when there's illness. You appreciate life when one is near death. One appreciates a connection that one had with a loved one, sometimes only when the loved one is gone. Right? One of the perversities of human nature, that one does not appreciate goodness until one is confronted with the opposites. Right? So if life wouldn't have bad things in it, one would not appreciate the good in it, right? So consequently, we only appreciate the gift of freedom when we contemplate and think about what slavery was like. So it's a before and after type of thing. But there's a problem with the before and after analysis. That is, if I have to think about the slavery in order to appreciate the freedom, and that creates gratitude in my heart, the problem is, yeah, but God made me a slave. I mean, imagine, for example, if I took somebody and I threw them into a prison cell and I locked them up for 210 years, and then I come back and I free them and I say, now that you know what slavery is like, be grateful to me eternally because I freed you. Whatever it is, but the answer the person says is, who told you to put me in slavery? Meaning, instead of engendering gratitude, it might be exactly the opposite. Right? What was the story? The Chafetz Chaim used to tell the story. Somebody once asked him about there was a certain movement in Europe, very anti-religious, Haskalah, Enlightenment, and at some point they were doing something for Jewish relief. They were collecting money for charity. So somebody went to the Chafetz Chaim and said, you know, we ought to be grateful to these movements because they're really raising a lot of money to help Jews who are suffering in pogroms. So the Chafetz Chaim told a story. He says, you know, I once saw a man who was walking in the streets, and he fell into a pit, a deep pothole, and he broke his legs. And another man rushed out and lifted him up and carried him and gave him food and drink and medical attention. And I went over to the man, the rescuer, and I said, I'm so jealous of your Olam Haba that you're giving so much of yourself to help a Jew in distress, such a great, great mitzvah. And the man said, don't admire me, Rebbe. I'm the one who dug the pit. You know. So the Chafetz Chaim actually said that the tzaros that befall Klal Yisrael come because the Torah is not being kept. That's what creates the tzaros. So then, when people come and they want to rescue, Baruch Hashem, they're rescuing. But still, you know, part of them, part of that contributed to digging the pit. So here is the idea: I'm grateful to Hashem because He took me out of an awful slavery. But Hashem dug the pit. The slavery was decreed. So the answer, therefore, has to be deeper. The concept of thinking about slavery as a precursor to freedom is not simply, let's appreciate the freedom by remembering the slavery. But rather, in the slavery itself, there is something to be grateful for. It's not a before and after. The slavery itself was something to be makir tov in retrospect for. It is the slavery itself that is part of the redemption that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us. How can slavery be part of the redemption? Once again, the Kor HaBarzel analogy. And to give it a specific context, the Beis Halevi mentions the following thought. All of us know the well-known Gemaras that even though the Jews reached the 49th level of impurity, they had a few merits that enabled them to be saved. They didn't change their names, their languages. They didn't intermarry. They didn't speak Lashon Hara. They wore distinctive Jewish clothing. There are different lists, but these are the ideas. The idea of ethnic identity, of identifying as a Jew, which is really achdus, unity. They were Ovdei Avodah Zarah. They were not from. They were idol worshippers. But they identified themselves as Jews. That seems to indicate that the one merit they had was the sense of being a nation, even though it did not express itself religiously. Which, by the way, is a very important idea. That you see that if you regard yourself as part of Klal Yisrael, that is a basis for you to be redeemed, even if you don't even keep mitzvahs. It was the identification as part of Klal Yisrael. But the Beis Halevi points out, l'chaira, this is contradicted by a Medrash. Because the Medrash says, when Yosef and all the brothers died, the descendants said the following, if we are so successful in Mitzrayim, when we behave differently, when we're distinct and isolated and separate, how much more successful will we be if we assimilate and we intermingle? And therefore, the Medrash says, the Jewish people resolved, this is before they became slaves, to assimilate, to intermarry, to become part of Egyptian culture. And therefore, the Medrash says, Hashem decreed that Paro would make them avadim. So when the Jews say, I want to be like the Egyptians push them away as a slave class. And this is the meaning of the pasuk in Tehillim, Hafach Libam Lisno Amo. God changed the heart of the Egyptians that had been filled with love and appreciation for the Jews, and it turned into hatred. This is one of the divine ways that unfortunately Jews are kept separate and distinct. That is, as Jews try to become more and more closer to the Umos HaOlam, the Umos HaOlam sometimes push us away so that we know we have to be separate and distinct. Yeah. That's correct. But that was the whole point. That's correct. But that's exactly the point. That in Yosef's time, the Jews were very successful. And they were so successful, they thought, let's be more successful. And at that point, the hatred entered the hearts of the Egyptians. Remember, it says, V'yakam melech chadash. There was a new king. According to one interpretation, there was a new king. According to another interpretation, it was the same old king. But it's as if he never heard of this Yosef fellow. What have you done for me lately? Which is, by the way, you know, I'm not an alarmist at all, but this is people point out to the fact that often the greatest calamities have befallen the Jewish people right after the highest prosperities and the greatest level of assimilation. The greatest, right? The Holocaust came not from Poland, although we know that the majority of the Jews were in fact in Poland, but the origin of the Holocaust came from a country in which Jews had reached the highest levels of acceptance, the Spanish Inquisition, the Golden Age of Spain. That's why people do have some fears about the United States, in which Jews reach such a high level of position. But the point is, in fact, the Meshech Chachma, Meir Simcha, even writes in Parshas Bechukosai, which is the Tochacha, that's what God says about all the things that will happen. And Meshech Chachma must have been written after World War I, well before 1933, that those Jews who look at Berlin as their Yerushalayim will see a tremendous korban coming from Berlin. Very prophetic words. Although I'll have to say, if I could digress for a second, I still never figured this out exactly. In the Great Gatsby, which was written also in the early 1920s, well before Hitler, there is a curious reference in the middle of the book to a swastika. I don't know if anyone remembers this. And you wonder where Fitzgerald got that image. And in fact, so who knows, maybe there were some intimations about Nazism, but again, even Mein Kampf was not published that early, so it's interesting how certain ideas somehow got communicated. But be it as it may, therefore, the Beis Halevi says there's a fundamental contradiction. What's the contradiction? One Medrash seems to portray the Jews after Yosef's death in a long rush towards assimilation. But the other Medrash seems to portray the notion of separateness. Separate language, separate culture, separate clothing. What was it? Was it assimilation or was it separatism? The Beis Halevi says it was both. First it was assimilation, and it was the slavery experience that forced us to look inward and concentrate on the achdus that we have with each other. It is a bracha Again, it's not a bracha we seek, and we hope we could be zocha to it in other ways. But it is a bracha when God shows us we cannot fully mix. When God shows us we have to be separate. When God shows us we cannot depend on the Umos HaOlam for our ultimate salvation. What is the expression? Nations have no friends, only have interests. And when interests coincide, that's fine. You can walk together on the same road. But there really is, at least in an international sense, there really is no such thing as friends. Because ultimately it's each nation to himself, ultimately it's each person to himself. And therefore, all we have, in an ultimate sense, is each other, and of course our relationship to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So the Beis HaLevi says that the zechus of not changing language, not changing clothing, was because of the slavery itself. So we can look at that slavery now and say, that made us a nation. It was not just the taking out of Mitzrayim that made us a nation. It was the avdus in Mitzrayim itself. So when you're maschil b'gnus, you're not just saying, oh, I'm grateful for the freedom, so I remember the slavery. But one recognizes how the slavery itself created that sense of shared destiny, even though it didn't manifest itself in mitzvos that much. There's another aspect, too. The Torah says, v'yahavtem es hager, you must love the convert. Ki gerim hayisem b'eretz Mitzrayim, because you were strangers in Egypt. A remarkable pasuk, a pasuk that is very, very relevant today. You know, today, one of the outstanding characteristics of American society is its emphasis on victimhood and victimization. In other words, people come forward with the various abuses that have been inflicted upon them, and acknowledgement is required, etc. All sorts of issues come up. And what does one do? What does one do if one has been victimized? In many ways, emotional abuse, sexual abuse, physical abuse, destructive marriage, there are all sorts of victimhoods that a person could experience. A person could respond to their victimhood in one of two ways. One is to erect a protective shell around themselves to be sure that they will never be hurt again. That there is a mechanism of self-preservation where one develops a certain toughness, self-protection, maybe self-absorption, to be sure that no one is ever going to get close enough to them to be able to harm them. There is another way one can respond, and that is, instead of trying to forget that pain and cover it up, there is the concept of being in touch with it. Remembering what it's like, remembering what it feels like, so that one can develop empathy and compassion for others who are suffering. What does the Torah say? Remember what it's like to be a slave. Remember what it's like to be a stranger, to be downtrodden, to be oppressed, to be despised. Don't forget it. Don't insulate yourself from that. Because then you can take that past and you can look at other people who come into your community. Now, a ger means a convert, but a ger also means a stranger, because the concept was the ger had no family, the ger had no property in Eretz Israel, the ger had no friends when they joined the Jewish people. And God says, when you look at that person, and of course we could extrapolate not just the ger, it applies to the stranger who comes to shul, or the widow, or the divorced person, or the child who is neglected, and you look at them and you remember, there was a time in my collective life, my national life, in which we were that person. And let's try to remember how it felt to be that person. And then it gets translated into empathy. And that's a tremendous thing, that you don't escape your pain, and you don't become self-absorbed to be sure that it doesn't happen to you. But you remember that experience and you translate it into empathetic compassion towards others who are similarly situated. And the truth of the matter is, that is the only way, really, one can escape their own personal pain. Because because sometimes when we try to just keep it within us, it eats at us, it keeps on getting in and in and in and in and in, that one can escape that curse of obsession and absorption only by translating it into gestures that can help others and raise them up. Yeah, I'm sure many of you have read All for the Boss. All for the Boss, Rebbe Tzvi Shane's autobiography of her father, of Yaakov Yosef Herman, very, very outstanding individual. But at the beginning of the book, she recounts a story about her father. That her father originally came with his parents as an 11-year-old or a 10-year-old, and then they had to go back to Europe, an amazing thing, for the rest of the family. And they left him here. They left him here as a 12-year-old boy. And they left him with a cousin. He was going to work already. There were no, in those days, children, worked. He had a job, and the deal was that he would stay at a cousin, just a cousin, and it would be $1 a week or something in rent. And as soon as his parents left, they raised the rent. You got to pay $2 a week. I don't remember the exact, something like that. And he could not pay it. So he was kicked out. He was kicked out on the street. And it was Friday. And he spent Friday night in Central Park, 12-year-old boy, by himself. And he had like some challahs with him. He couldn't even, there was no air in there, so he couldn't move them around. But he sat on the park bench, and he made kiddush and rolls, and he ate some rolls. And you can imagine, I mean, it's true that Central Park was a lot safer then. That probably was true. Today, it would mamash be pikuach nefesh, he'd be allowed to
get. Why didn't he go to the synagogue? Why not the congregants themselves?
Well, I'll tell you, in those days, in those days, they used to lock up the synagogues. There were a lot of things. I mean, in those days, they would kick you out, for some reason. Because unfortunately, there were kids wandering around who were orphaned and had no place to go. I mean, it wasn't as organized as today, where children would be taken in. And as he's sitting there by himself, frightened and cold, he says he made a vow to himself that if Hashem ever gives him the chance to have a home, he would never let another person go through what he went through. And if you know the book, you know the story that one of his outstanding mitzvahs was the number of guests and hospitality that he showed, 20, 30, 40, 50 people constantly. But what does a person do? In other words, you see, a person remembers what that was like. And that's exactly what the Torah says. Remember the stranger, because you were strangers in the land of Egypt. So when we talk about what Hashem gave us, it's not just the freedom that he gave us. It is also that growth that the Avdus himself gave us. And that is the Kor HaBarzel, that is the fire that strengthens a character, that is the fire of adversity that gives the person the great opportunity to grow and achieve aliyah. And this was the kinyan, this is the acquisition that we get in Yetzias Mitzrayim. Right? So the inner meaning of maschil b'gnus u'masayim b'shvach, you begin with the slavery and you culminate in the redemption, is not just a before and an after, but it's a recognition that in the avdus itself there's a tremendous geula. In this sense, there are two midrashim I just want to share with you. All of us know that yesterday's parsha is the source of the mitzvah of drinking four cups of wine. Right? We have four cups of wine because there are four lashonos of redemption. Vautseisi, I will take you out. Vihitzalti, I will save you. Vigaalti, I will redeem you. Vulakachti, I will take you unto me for a nation. There is also a fifth term, Ve'ivesi Eschem, I will bring you to Eretz Yisrael, which refers to the final Yemos HaMashiach. And since we haven't achieved that yet, we have the fifth cup, but we do not drink it. See, by the way, people make a mistake. It's called the Kos of Eliyahu. So some people say, because Eliyahu comes to every Seder and drinks, the children are watching, does the cup go down a little bit? But the simple meaning why it's called the Kos of Eliyahu is, it's a kos that will not be drunk until Mashiach comes, whose arrival will be announced by Eliyahu. It's the kos that we're holding for when Eliyahu comes. That's the simple meaning why it's kosher Eliyahu. By the way, there is an opinion in the Gemara, by the way, that does say you have a fifth cup. And there were poskim, and there are Hasidim today, who are no egg to have a fifth cup, so that they actually drink it. They split halal into two. In fact, in the Haggadah of the Maharal is quoted as saying, you have to have a fifth cup, although some recent scholarship has said that that is a forgery, and that's not the Maharal's position. So this is a little strange. If you open up the Maharal's Haggadah, you will see the Maharal is a strong advocate of the fifth cup, but they say, there's a whole machlokas whether the Maharal's Haggadah was even written by the Maharal. I think some of you may use the Haggadah. Let me just give you a little information on that. There is a Haggadah on the market, which is called the Haggadah of the Maharal. I believe it may even have been translated into English. I'm not sure. I haven't seen the English. Now, if you...
Hebrew or English?
No, Hebrew. Yeah, Hebrew. Now, if you look at it, you will see the... see that the commentary is 95% an anthology of Gevuras Hashem. So it is 95% the words of the Maharal, but it was commonly thought the Maharal himself made a kitzer of Gevuras Hashem and applied it on the Haggadah, but more recent scholarship suggests that this was a creation in the 19th century of somebody who took the Maharal's words and added some other instructions which are not the Maharal. So the fifth cup is one of the major issues. We just said the Maharal Shita was not to have a fifth cup. Be it as it may, we have these four Lashonos, and that's why we have four cups of wine. Now, there are two Midrashim. One Midrash says that the four cups of wine, I'm sorry, the four Lashonos of redemption, why four, correspond to four decrees of Paro. There were four Gezeros of Paro that were decreed on the Jewish people. The first gezeira was slavery. The second gezeira is when he ordered the miyaldos, Shifra and Pua, to strangle the babies. That didn't work. The third gezeira was when he told the soldiers to throw the babies in the water. And the fourth gezeira is when, after Moshe came, Hashem told him to that from now on, the Jewish people have to gather their own straw. Okay, these are four gezeros, and Yetzias Mitzrayim liberated us from these four gezeros. By the way, just let me digress for a moment on this. Of the four gezeros, you know, the fourth one doesn't seem to be that bad. You know, you have to gather the world's straw. What's the big deal? And yet we find that Moshe complained to Hashem, Lama hareyosa liyam hazeh. Why have you made things worse? I didn't want to go, and you sent me, and things are worse. And the Medrash makes a point that how did Moshe complain to Hashem? With the word us. Umei us basi el paro. From the time I came to Paro, you made it worse. Hashem tells Moshe, you are complaining to me with the word as, us, chayecha, by your life. That very word will be what you will praise me with. And that is us, Yashir, Moshe. What's the connection? So Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, I mentioned this yesterday in Shul, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky says this. He says an interesting thought. He says, why did things have to get worse before they get better? He says, because the Jews should have been in Mitzrayim 400 years. That's what Hashem told Abraham. But they couldn't stay 400 years because they would have hit the 50th level of Tuma. They would have been irredeemable. So how did Hashem get his 400 years within 210 years? There are many pshatim. But some say, by making the Avdus worse than it would have been normally, Hashem got in within 210 a qualitative koshi hashibut that was equivalent to 400. But here's the idea. Hashem calibrates it exactly. Hashem knows exactly what is the avdus of 400 years. And the Jews have to be redeemed right now or within a few months or they're going to hit level 50. So it had to get a certain degree worse, because if there wouldn't have been that extra rise, maybe they would have to be in Mitzrayim 212 years to get the Koshi Hashibut. And that would have been too late. So Hashem is telling Moshe, the very thing you're complaining about is the reason for the redemption. It's an amazing thing. It's so precisely calibrated that the extra level of Shibud in gathering straw was what was necessary to complete the 400 years on time. Without it, you would need 211 years, let us say. But that's too late. 211 years, they're gone. It means, and this is what life is about, the very thing that we think is to our disadvantage turns out to be the key for what we need. Just like in Mitzrayim, the Gnus. Umei us, you complain about the us, it will be the us. That us that you complained about is the us Yashir Moshe, the basis for the redemption. So anyway, going back to the Midrashim, Midrash number one has these four gezeros of Paro. Avdus, the killing of the strangling of the babies by the midwives, then the throwing of the babies in the water, and then the gathering of the straw. That's Midrash one. Medrash 2 says that the four gezeros, the four redemptions, do not refer to Mitzrayim at all only, but they refer to the four exiles. In other words, Hashem, remember when Moshe asked Hashem, what is your name? So Hashem answered, Eke Asher Eke, I am, or I will be, which, what I will be. And Rashi explains that Hashem is saying, tell them, just as I will be with them in Mitzrayim, I will be with them in all their other tzaras. And then Hashem, as it were, changes his mind and says, just tell them I'm Ekeh. Don't say Ekeh Sher Ekeh, because Rashi says, Moshe said to Hashem, I should tell them there's other tzaras? He says, okay, just tell them I'll be with them in this one. But there is indeed Ekeh Sher Ekeh. And therefore, there's a remez in the four Lashonas of Geula. Not just Geula from Mitzrayim, but Geula from the four Golios. Redemption from Bavel, redemption from Persia, redemption from Greece, Yavan, redemption from Edom. Right? So we have two different Midrashim. One focuses on the four Gezeros of Paro, and one focuses on the four Golios. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a very good question. That redemption hasn't happened yet. Well, I guess there are two stages, in other words. There is the redemption from the Shibud Golias, and then there's the building of the Beis HaMikdash. There's the positive and the negative. The fourth one is the redemption from the negative destruction of the fourth Golias, and the fifth is the positive rebuilding. But according to that, but the point you're making is a well-taken point, and that is, if I'm drinking the fourth cup in anticipation of the future redemption that hasn't occurred yet, then I ought to drink the fifth cup as well. Maybe, in a chidami. According to that medrash, maybe you would have five cups, as some people do. Now, here is the thing. Rav Gedalia Shor has a very interesting analysis here. He says that the two midrashim are complementary with the E, meaning they're two sides of the same coin. Because it says in the Svarim that the reason why Klal Yisrael had to undergo four Golios is because we never really finished our business in Mitzrayim. Had we been in Mitzrayim for the full 400 years, we would have rectified everything that we needed to rectify. And there would be no need. Again, it's, you know, the hospital, sometimes when people stop a medical treatment too early because it's very devastating on them, they weren't able to get rid of the whole disease. They didn't go through the process. And therefore, the need for the four Golios is because we never completed the process in Mitzrayim.
400 years, yeah. Most of them could be dead.
Meaning, if we would have completed the 400... Now, we couldn't complete it because we would have been the 15th level of Tumah. But had we been able to complete that process, the rule would have been, or the situation would have been, would not have needed other Golios. Yeah. Oh, so here is the thing. So, and the way it works is the following, therefore. Egypt was a microcosm of all of the Golias. And the interesting thing he says, therefore, is the four Gezeros of Paro, which is only one nation, parallel the four Golioses that we had to go through. Just as in Mitzrayim there were four stages, although albeit one nation, that's true, we have the same four stages. Now, so the question then becomes to match them up, to match up. So the first Gezeirah of Paro is supposed to match Golus Bavel. The second Gezeirah of Paro is supposed to match Golus Paras, which was a very short Golus, as we'll see. The third Gezeirah of Paro matches up Golus Yavan. And the Gezeirah of the straw matches up the Golus that we are in. In other words, because we didn't fully live through those four gezeros, they were truncated prematurely, we go through the four gullies. Yeah.
I have a question about God's intervention. We were talking about before, that we intensify the oppression to make the student people
right.
Equal to the poor.
Right, right.
If you say that the reason God had to intervene is because the Jews would not have remained a nation because of the Shari Tsuma.
Right.
It seems to me that once you say, well, God could intervene in the affairs of man, God could have intervened either two ways, either by increasing the oppression or by preventing the Jews from reaching the low
spiral.
Okay. Yeah. Is there a philosophical basis under which we say, well, God can intervene in one way but not in another?
Sure,
way?
Absolutely. The idea is that God is extremely reluctant to interfere in the moral choices that human beings make.
So he's interfering in the moral choices that the Israelites make
by making them oppress harder. Well, you could say not necessarily. You could say that would be Hashem allowed them. In other words, Hashem would normally have stopped them from excessively oppressing. Hashem gave the Mitzrayim free reign. But even if it's true that Hashem interfered with their free will, which of course gets us into the issue later of Hashem hardening Paro's heart, we could still say that Hashem is more willing to do that with Yumos Ha'olam than with Bnei Yisrael. In other words, Hashem's relationship with Bnei Yisrael is predicated on free will and free choice and autonomy, and therefore there's an extreme divine reluctance to interfere with that free will. But Hashem will manipulate circumstances so that your free will not be exercised to the ultimate destruction of Sharnun. By the way, a little more, again, a little digression from the Chassam Sofer. The Chassam Sofer says that the koach of Yom Kippur, which brings forgiveness, can even redeem a person from the 50th level of Tumah. And he has a little drush that says this. In the Mishnah of Yuma, Rabbi Akiva has a rhetorical question. Like this is a Simchas Torah song. You know, Ashrechem Yisrael, happy are you, Yisrael, lifnei mi atem etaharim, in front of whom do you purify yourself, umi metar eskem, and who purifies you? And Rabbi Akiva answers, Avichem Shebashamayim, your father in heaven, and therefore rejoice. Right? This is sung in Simchas Torah. So the Chassam Sofer has a drasha, lifnei mi, which means in front of whom? But mi, mem yud, is begematria 50. So lifnei mi, when you're not yet at the 50th level, comma, atem mitaharim, you can still purify yourself. Umi, but when you're at the mi, when you're at level 50, mitaher eschem, Hashem will purify you. So there is a concept that the Kayach of Yom Kippur is even if you're the Sharnut. But okay, be it as it may, certainly in the Mitzrayim we were told that had we stayed even a little bit longer. In fact, remember what the Ari says. When it says they didn't have time to let their dough rise, the Ari says that doesn't mean because the Egyptians were chasing us out. We don't even know what this means, but it means if we would have stayed the amount of time it takes. I mean, we were what? We were 18 minutes away from the 50th level. We would have stayed that amount of, like less than 18 minutes, because it does take a certain amount of time to bake matzah too, right? If we would have stayed that extra few minutes, we don't even know what that means. But that's how critical, that's how bad it was. Yeah.
If we had reached the 50th level, how would that have fulfilled the promise to Abraham?
Well, that's why Hashem couldn't let that happen. That's exactly right. But if
so
it would have happened,
we wouldn't have reached the 50th.
Hashem would not have allowed that to happen. Hashem had in his plan that that wouldn't happen, but he had to do so without interfering with our free will. So he had to make the Shebud worse and everything else. Yeah. Right. Okay, so, yeah. No. So the answer has to be that, you know, once again, it's like a cancer analogy, and that is to say, if you didn't get the little bit that needed to be fixed in Mitzrayim, there were a devious disease that could spread and culminate in all sorts of awful averos. So the averos that culminated in the destruction of the first base of Mikdash and the second base of Mikdash, would their shorish, their root, would have been eradicated through the process of Mitzrayim. And that would mean, I mean, imagine what that would have been. We would have gone to Eretz Yisrael with Moshe Rabbeinu. There would have been a base of Mikdash forever. There wouldn't have been any Golus at all. That would have been the end of the whole business. So, on one hand, we had to be taken out when we were taken out, but it had a cost. Yeah. Right, that's what I want to talk about now. So what I want to talk about now is the connection briefly between the four Paro decrees and the four Golios. The first three are, let's see. The first one is Bavel, right? I'm sorry, the first degree of Paro is enslavement. That's what Bavel did. Bavel conquered us. Bavel enslaved us. Bavel put us into Golos. Bavel was not particularly anti-Semitic, by the way. Bavel was not, I mean, although Bavel murdered and the like, but they did so as part of their conquest. The purpose of Golus Bavel was subjugation and enslavement. And that corresponds to the very first Gezerah of Paro. The second Gezerah of Paro was genocide. He ordered the Mialdos to murder newborn babies. That does correspond with the Golus of Persia, because although the Golus of Persia was a very short exile, because between the end of Babylon and the conquest by Alexander the Great was less than 100 years. It was a very short Golus. But the most outstanding event of that time was the Purim story of Haman. Haman, of course, wanted to destroy. Now remember, just like Haman wanted to destroy and he wasn't successful, that second Gezeirah, in which he wanted the Miyaldos to kill the Jews, was unsuccessful. It was attempted genocide, which was never carried out. Exactly the same as Haman. The third Gezeirah and its connection to Yavin is a bit more subtle. The third Gezeirah was, he told the men, the soldiers, to drown the babies. How is drowning connected to Yavin? So here it's understood on a more metaphorical, non-literal way. Water is often used for wisdom. And wisdom is a good thing. Wisdom is necessary for spiritual life, just like water is necessary for physical life. And yet, water can also drown you and choke you. We know that the Gullus of Yavan was a Gullus that tried to destroy our souls more than our bodies. The struggle of Hanukkah was a struggle of Torah versus Hellenism, with Greek philosophy, Greek knowledge, Greek culture, which had wonderful wisdom and insight in it. But if you use it in derogation of Torah, you drown in it. So consequently, drowning in water could be comparable to drowning in the Chachma of Yavanis, in which you get blinded and destroyed from the wisdom of the Torah. Yeah, it seems there definitely were some casualties. Moshe Rabbeinu was saved, but besides Moshe Rabbeinu, many were saved miraculously. But it does seem that there were some. So unlike the Bialdos, in which nothing was ever carried out, this seems to have been carried out in part. But what's most interesting is the fourth Gezeirah. And this is very fascinating, because the fourth Gezeirah should be the most important for us, because that's our Gullus. We got to gather straw. Okay, how does gathering straw connect to the Gullus Edom? So Rav Gedalia Shor points out that the Lashon of this fourth Gezeirah was that the Jews were ordered that from now on you must scatter to gather your straw. The notion of pizur, scatterness, and the characteristic of the fourth Gullus is one of scattering. How is that so? On many, many levels. First, there is the geographic dispersion, which is the greatest in this Gullus, right? In Gullus Yava and all the other Gulluses, you know, Jews were concentrated in a relatively small number of countries. Egypt, Babylonia, etc. In this Gullus, Jews are everywhere. I saw an advertisement for Rabbi Franz Tapes. I think they made the point that he has listeners on every continent in the world, including Antarctica. There's somebody there who has a Rabbi Franz tape, right? So there are Jews in Antarctica, okay? Jews are everywhere. Families don't live together. Unfortunately, people get together, if it's good, it's for a simcha, and often it's only for difficult tragedies. So even on a geographical level, we live a Gullus of Pizur. But more importantly, we live a Gullus of Pizur on the emotional level. The characteristic of the Gullus of Edom is sinas chinam, hatred. What is hatred other than barriers, divisions, separateness, estrangements? And this translates not only in Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, but between husbands and wives, marital discord, between parents and children, breakdown of families. Again, I'm not just referring to among the Torah community, although unfortunately we have that as well, but among the world at large, the breakdowns of family structures. And finally, there is the pizur, the scatteredness, the estrangement within a person himself, in which a person is confused, not knowing where to go, not knowing where to turn. The head is pulling one way, the heart is pulling another way. So we have geographical dispersion, we have interpersonal dispersion, we have division and dichotomy and fragmentation within the person himself. And we live in a world where even when there's affluence and prosperity, A person often is confused and does not know where to go. I mentioned before advertisements. There's a gourmet store at Chevy Chase. I once said that advertised 500 types of mustard. So speaking, you know, sometimes, you know, your spouse may ask you, go get some mustard before Shabbos. So you figure, all right, I have, you know, I have 20 minutes. I'll go over to the store. And you walk into a store with 500 types of mustard. You know, what are you, assuming they're all kosher? I don't know. But, you know, you could die from indecision, basically. So the idea of confusion, or if you want to try to buy a computer, for example, very, very difficult, you know. But you know, all these different things. So this is Pizur. Pizur is the inner turmoil and confusion of not finding your way. And that's the fourth gullus, and that's Pizur. And that's why the word Pizur is used. So the four gezeros of Paro parallel the four gullios, you see? And because we didn't finish the work, by the way, this is a very important lesson in life. It's a lesson in life, a very practical lesson. And that is, when you sweep things under the rug, they come back to haunt you in a much bigger form. You got to try to take care of things. You know, you think, well, I'll just push it away and, you know, make believe it's not here. But what is the whole lesson here? It comes back in a bigger and meaner and more intensive form because you didn't deal with it when you could have dealt with it. And, you know, this is a lesson I think we learn over and over and over and over again. We never learn it, but, you know, it comes back. It's something that we're always going to face. And this exactly is the meta-history of Klal Yisrael, that because of that unfinished business, things come back. And this is really, by the way, this is a general way of understanding Chazal. Going back to the very first Gemara I told you, when Chazal identify some horrendous thing that happened later because of some little thing that happened hundreds of years before, they don't mean to say it was a little thing that caused, you know, that is the onesh or something. They mean to say that the little thing that gets unchecked flowers, if that's the right word, into tremendous defects of character that eventually warrant a catastrophic response. In other words, because it grows. Yeah. No, no, that's very true. That's very true. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, there are things in life that are, you know, totally beyond our comprehension, and you know, I don't know how to deal with it other than to say that, you know, there are people that do deal with it. People react different ways. People respond different ways. Even Elie Wiesel, I mentioned, you know. After 50 or 60 years, you know, he writes in the New York Times, he wants to have a relationship with Hashem once again. It's very difficult for someone who has not gone through that experience to tell somebody how to deal with it. But I would think that the best avenue would be to share the agony and the pain with people who understand what that was like and somehow strengthen each other because you've gone through that together. Rav Aaron Cutler, they say, Aaron Cutler used to, was, you know, Aaron Cutler never wasted a minute. He was a tremendous masmid. But once or twice a week for a long period of time after World War II, he used to play chess with somebody for 2 hours a day. You know, and this made no sense at all to any of his talmidim. Like, you know, like, why is the Russian even doing this? But this was a Holocaust survivor who had gone through the war, and he couldn't talk about anything. He had lost his family. He could not talk about anything. But playing chess with Rav Aaron made him feel, it calmed him down, it made him feel a little better. And Rav Aaron said, I'll give him 2 hours a day. Just, you know. So there are different coping strategies. All I'm saying is that the Holocaust, of course, was something in which a gigantic thing hit you all at once. But often in life, it doesn't work that way. Often there are small things, and you know, we can attack them in manageable bites, and then we become disabled if we don't. you know, again, we certainly can't explain every single step in the process, but the Svarim do point out that there was an element of unfinished business in Yetzias Mitzrayim. Yeah. Well, we're still in the fourth Galus, so obviously we are paying the price. Now, you might say the other way, maybe, perhaps, by paying the price over a longer period of time, maybe we're getting less intensity. In fact, the Maharal says an interesting thought. This is actually a very interesting way of twisting it around. You know, people ask a big question on the Ten Commandments. The Aseret HaDibros says, Poked Avon Avos Albanim. Hashem remembers the sins of the parents on the children. So people say, that's grossly unfair. Children are being punished for the sins of the parents. So here's what the Maharal says. The Maharal says, that is a Midas HaRachamim, at least for the parent, not necessarily for the kids, in that, instead of all of the onesh for an aveira, I mean, let's quantify it. Let's assume that the onesh of an aveira is to lose $1 million. So let's just make up a number. So instead of saying, you have to lose $1 million, Hashem will cause all of your future generations to lose $1 a year. And the midah of rachamim is that onesh can be spread. Same principle as insurance, right? Well, what is the theory of insurance? Right? It's loss spreading, meaning to say that for me to lose, let's say, my $100,000 is an awful thing, but if people pay premiums in insurance, so each one is paying $1 extra to cover the person who loses $100,000, so for each person to pay $1 isn't so bad, right? So the Maharal actually says that spreading something over a longer period of time is an attribute of divine mercy. Of course, it's not a complete answer, because it's an act of divine mercy vis-a-vis the parents who would otherwise have to pay $1 million. It's not divine mercy vis-a-vis the kid who wouldn't have had to pay the dollar. I mean, it's not a complete answer, but at least it's a way of understanding that it's actually a midah of rachamim. In spreading means lowering the intensity that each individual has. Yeah. Well, they also connect me to kina, jealousy. Taiva is lust. Kavod is honor. And then the opposite is yiyosh. Yiyosh is a sense of worthlessness. And I have to work it out. I didn't see a direct connection to the four gazelles of Pyro, but it was worth to think about, see if we could connect them, because that would be an interesting exercise. Okay, again, I think I do have to go now, but have a good week. And again, I will not be here for the next 2 weeks, unfortunately. So our next share will be February 18th. That's President.